Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the Oscar-nominated film, Her, Joaquin Phoenix plays an introverted man who embarks on a new relationship.
The woman that I've been seeing, Samantha,
she's an operating system.
You're dating in a West? What is that like?
I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
Okay, a meaningful relationship with an artificially intelligent operating system is far-fetched science fiction, sure, at this point. But right now, some people have embarked on relationships with what might be precursors to Her. Joining us now by phone from New York to tell us more is Bianca Bosker, tech editor at the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your recent Huffington Post article, you profiled the Nintendo DS game Love Plus. What led you to look into this?
So what I thought was so interesting is I saw the movie Her, and, you know, kind of like you said, everyone talked about it as this science fiction nether reality that might exist one day. And that got me thinking, you know, what's the closest thing that we have now to Her? Is this something that, you know, a lot of people were arguing, well, maybe someday this could come around if a lot of things fall into place. What I found with the game Love Plus is that in some respects, Her is already here. You have a piece of software with which humans are actually bonding. So Love Plus lets people develop relationships with virtual girlfriends. And the players or, you know, boyfriends that I spoke with describe the support and love that they get from these virtual girls as being as real as one that they get from an actual person.
And this isn't even artificial intelligence we're talking about. I mean, they're really settling for something pretty two-dimensional.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this game is not that sophisticated. I mean, we're not talking about Siri here, even. If you can kind of imagine, the Nintendo DS, for those who don't know, is this handheld gaming system, and basically, the virtual girlfriends, there's three to choose from. They're high schoolers. They each have their own personality. And they basically appear as these animated figures with pre-recorded phrases that have been recorded by voice actresses and singers. So they can kind of carry a conversation. But again, they're not... they're going to be telling you some pretty basic things. They can speak to you and understand what you tell them, but only when it comes to some pretty simplistic dialogues around, you know, your favorite outfit or like your favorite kind of food or your favorite color. But the people that have gotten very involved with this game say that even though these aren't exactly philosophical discussions, it's really heartwarming.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Bianca Bosker, executive tech editor for the Huffington Post, about Love Plus. It's a Nintendo DS game that mimics slightly the concept brought forth in the movie Her. They're high school girls. Are the people men that males that are playing this game, are they high school boys?
No, they're not, and it's not exclusively men. So I actually spoke with a woman for the game who's very involved with it, although she's straight. She just sees her girlfriend as being a real friend and in some respects a better friend than actual people. I mean, if you think about it, these virtual girlfriends are always available. They can never, ever break up with you. This is not like a Tamagotchi where they'll disappear or die. They are yours forever. And even though they might get a little crabby if you're late for a date or don't call them for a while, they nonetheless are incredibly loyal and committed. It's a range of ages. I spoke with everyone from, I think, 19 to 32. And although it's a Japanese game that is only available officially in Japan in Japanese, the players I spoke with were all over the world, from South Africa to Michigan.
Do you have to speak Japanese to play it?
You do. There's an unofficial English translation of it that you can actually find. But you know, what's interesting is that a lot of people didn't speak Japanese all that well, and still somehow perhaps that actually allowed the suspension of disbelief to work a little bit better. You know, they were able to kind of imagine maybe more what these girlfriends were saying and how supportive they were. But most of them do speak or read at least a little bit of Japanese.
It was described to me as a game of flirting, but is it necessarily, is there anything carnal going on? Is there anything sexy going on? Or is it just more like a friend?
So it's even more than flirting. I mean, these are real relationships. There's two parts of the game. The first half ends when you and one of the girls decide that you're going to go study. And then this is what's so interesting and distinctive about Love Plus. Other games would just stop there. Love Plus lets you actually date that girl indefinitely. I mean, people can carry on these relationships longer than they'll be married. So, you know, one of the people I spoke with had been dating the Love Plus girl for going on, I think, 3 or 4 years. As for whether it's carnal or not, people do talk about being attracted to the virtual Love Plus girlfriends. But in the game itself, you can never go further beyond kissing, hand-holding, or what's called skinshipping, which is basically kind of heavy petting that involves using the stylus to kind of poke at the girls on the screen and, you know, touch their chest or pat their heads. Offline, however, there are these hugging pillows that basically have a life-size image of the characters on them that players will sleep with at night, sometimes even position across from them at the dinner table with their own plate of food.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a really fascinating subculture, and yeah. You know, perhaps they're weird, perhaps they're early adopters.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think this again could be the precursor to other types of relationships. But I hope that, you know, people read my piece. I think there are things about it that are very bizarre. I think the fact that these are high school girls in the game is strange and uncomfortable in a lot of ways. On the other hand, you know, they are more, you know, they're less complex than the kind of selfish algorithms that are other people. You know, one player talked about how when he comes home from work, you know, here's this virtual girlfriend who's always there for him, who always will have something nice and kind and supporting to say to him. And it makes you think about how often, you know, do we do that enough for each other? Hmm. Are we going to have to start looking to our smartphones for positive enforcement?
How involved are these games? We call them games. How much of a game is it?
That's a great question. It's not really a game in the same way that, you know, Call of Duty is a game.
Mm-hmm.
People don't play them necessarily to get to a high score or for the kind of intellectual challenge that a lot of people will play games like, you know, World of Warcraft.
Mm-hmm.
One of the players described playing Love Plus as a feeling of duty. I mean, he felt a real sense of obligation to check in with his girlfriend, to be kind to her, to take care of her. So it's much more, I think, about, again, emotional support and companionship than it is about a competitive drive to beat new levels.
Have you talked with anyone who broke up?
So again, the girls can't break up.
Right.
It's entirely in the player's control. Yeah, there are those, you know, I was looking specifically for people. Yeah, no, I did. I mean, I was looking for people that were playing it currently. But, you know, I did speak with people who had tired of the game. You know, they tried it out. And at some point, they stopped playing. There was also, there's a tale of a Japanese groom who at his wedding actually destroyed his Love Plus Nintendo DS on his wedding day with his bride at the wedding with this wooden mallet, I think as a kind of ritual breaking up, you know, or sort of a symbolic breaking up with his virtual girlfriend. And there were cases, you know, of married couples that had huge fights and falling outs over, you know, the virtual other woman, this virtual homewrecker. And guys who said that they were incredibly unhappy, but they basically had to quit the game in order to avoid getting a divorce.
Wow. Okay, so players can take snapshots of themselves with their arms around their girlfriends. How does that work?
So, yeah, what's interesting is the way that the game maker and players themselves have come up with very, very creative ways of basically taking the game and pushing it a little further. So, for example, you can take these augmented reality stickers, and when you hold your smartphone up to them, it will look through the camera's lens as though the person and the virtual girlfriend are there together.
What happens when they get snippy? Like if you've ignored him for a while, is it just the tone of voice? Because it's all pretty basic communication, right?
Yeah, it is. So one of the things that the game makers have done to make these Love Plus women seem more realistic is they have given them their own personalities and characters. So one of the girls, for example, is a little bit more quiet and withdrawn. Another one is a little bit more big sisterly. And kind of like real girlfriends, they will get upset if you are not nice to them. So, for example, if you're late for a date, you have to take them out on dates. That's the first thing. If you don't take them out on dates, they will get their feelings hurt and they will kind of give you the cold shoulder when you check in next time. If you're late for that date, likewise, you know, they'll kind of cross their arms, they'll furrow their brows, they'll be a little distant and dismissive when you see them. They might also send you an email in the game that says something like, you know, what happened to you? Where were you? I'm not mad. Please make sure that, you know, you don't, you know, we had a promise. Can't you keep a promise? So they will do a little bit of guilt tripping in the way that they speak to you or in the way that they communicate, you know, via email within the game itself.
How long has this game been around?
The game launched in 2009, and there have been three versions, I believe, with a fourth one due this spring.
Are they trying to make it more sophisticated?
There seem to be little efforts in place to do that. You know, the company that makes these would not comment on any aspect of the game, except to say that, that they, you know, declined my request for an interview, which, you know, I'd really hope to better understand what is the technology going on, you know, mm-hmm. that they're using, and to what extent are they integrating things like natural language processing and artificial intelligence, which would make these more sophisticated. But, you know, certainly they have looked for ways to make them more realistic. Just as one example, a couple of years ago, Konami, which is the game maker of Love Plus, launched a promotion to get the players to take their virtual girlfriends on real weekend getaways in this resort town in Japan. So in the game itself, you're supposed to take these girls to a hot springs resort in a town called Atami. And the town of Atami, the actual real town, launched this promotional campaign in conjunction with the game maker to invite the players to come out with their consoles, rent rooms for themselves and their virtual girlfriends, and spend the whole weekend wining and dining their computer games. And this was apparently very successful as well. I think 1,500 couples, if you can call them that, showed up in the first month or two, I want to say. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, that's kind of blurring the lines.
Kind of, yeah. We just have about a minute left, but I wanted to know if the maker they didn't do the interview with you, but do you know if they have plans to expand into other languages, other cultures?
That's everyone's question. I mean, you can believe me, the fans of the game have been really desperate for them to do that for a long, long time. If people are interested in seeing what it's like or checking it out, there's a lot of play-by-play YouTube videos of the game. And again, there's what's called an English language patch, which means that you can download, it's kind of a half, you know, they speak in Japanese, but there's English subtitle, if you will, on the game. And there's a lot of guides in English to the game. So, you know, if people can't exactly read all the Japanese text, there's a lot of communities online where they can see the translations and make their way through it. But you know, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see how they do it. One interesting thing is, though, a lot of the players will tell you that this game was created to help Japanese men refine their dating skills, and a lot of them say they use it as practice. The game maker, the only thing they would tell me is that is not true, that the game was not and will not improve your dating skills. was not made to improve your dating skills.
Okay, well, yeah. Bianca, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think it's a fascinating game.
Bianca Bosker, she is executive tech editor for the Huffington Post. Coming up, we're going to talk about, if you're forgetting those dates with virtual girlfriend, that means you need to get better organized. And we're going to talk about apps that'll help you do that when we return to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Emails, the ever-multiplying messages in your email system is one of the biggest ways we get bogged down and distracted during a workday, during our lives. It's hard to stay productive when new distractions, as in emails, keep pouring in all the time, but there are some useful apps out there that can help get your inbox under control. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles to share some of the best productivity apps is Josh Ong. He's a reporter for TheNextWeb.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Question for listeners, what apps are you using that help you stay productive? Give us a call at 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Josh, you wrote about a couple email-related apps. Let's start with Mailbox for iOS. How does it work?
Well, Mailbox was the breakout app of 2013. You know, it launched and quickly got hundreds of thousands of people wanting to get into the service, but they had a wait list because they were kind of processing the emails on their end, and so they needed to scale up. And the way it works is it takes your traditional email inbox and turns it into more of a to-do list. And so what happens is you use these multi-touch gestures like swiping and tapping, and depending on the length of your swipe, it'll determine what you do with that email, whether you file it away, whether you schedule it for something to do. And I think it's a great way to rethink how we do email. Most of the stuff that comes into our inboxes, it's stuff that we need to act on, you know, and then stuff that we need to dismiss. And so coming through and finding all the noise and getting rid of it in order to find those important emails that we need to, schedule or take action on is really helpful for our productivity.
Does it work with all email clients?
Well, no, that was an issue. Early on, it worked mostly with Gmail, mm-hmm. and then later on in the year, they did add Yahoo as well as the Apple iCloud account.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that is still quite limited. You know, it's only on iOS. They are working on an Android version. And they got purchased by Dropbox in March, about a month or two after they launched. And I think that the reason for that deal is they realized Mailbox realized that the demand for their service was so great that they needed a bigger company to come in and help them really get a better reach and meet all that demand. So we can expect Mailbox, because of its Dropbox now coming in to help it, to really add a lot of features and refine its service a lot more this year. So you can look forward to that.
Another app designed to help manage the inbox is called The Swizzle, and this one really takes aim at the junk, which I'm going through a period right now. I'm getting a lot more junk. I don't know why that is, but how does Swizzle work?
Well, The Swizzle's interesting. You take the service and let it take a look at your inbox, and it'll find all these newsletters that you get, promotions, deals, offers, and it's not the only service of its kind. You can also find things like Unroll.me and Sift, and even Gmail itself is working on sorting your promotions out if you use the new interface. But the idea is to take all that email that you don't want to see and file it away somewhere so it's still available for you if you do want to go look at, you know, the latest deals from Pottery Barn or whatever you get as a newsletter. But a lot of these services, what they do is rather than having to look at, you know, hundreds of different emails separately, they'll combine them into a digest and we'll send them as one email, and you can just scan it, see if there's anything interesting, and then archive it or delete it, if not.
And Gmail has taken a step in this direction, too, with a promotions tab?
Yeah, if you use the new Gmail, you'll notice they have a social tab, which is for all the notifications from things like Twitter and Facebook, as well as a promotions tab as well for finding all those marketing emails with discounts or, just brands trying to sell you stuff. So the way Google thinks of it is you have your main email, which is all your important stuff, and then every once in a while, maybe a couple times a day, you might pop over to those other tabs to see, what's going on with my social media? What's going on with all the different promotions and, marketing emails? So it's an interesting way to do it, and there's a pretty mixed response to it. I actually haven't switched over to the new Gmail interface because it doesn't really work with how I structure my inbox. But, my boss, who's a productivity nut, loves it. And he had 50 filters for his Gmail inbox. He took them all away, uses the new Gmail, and loves it. So it's really up to you.
It seems like with all of these apps to manage your email that, a lot of people say, I don't use email anymore or I don't want to use email anymore. But it sounds like email's really the best there is out there at this point, and it's probably here to stay. We have to manage it.
Sure. I mean, I know people who have given up on email and they get direct messages on Twitter instead, or they find other ways to communicate. And there's certainly, I could understand why anybody would give up email if you've if you ever looked at your inbox after coming back from vacation and done a, read all or mark all as read. It's certainly tempting. And the great thing is we have so many different ways to connect with each other now that you can skip email if you want, but for a lot of jobs, it's really necessary. And it's ubiquitous. Everybody who's working today has an email, and it's just a great way to get in touch. So, sorting out the emails we need from the ones we don't, it's going to save us a lot of time.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Josh Ong, a reporter for The Next Web. We're talking about productivity apps. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is there a particular productivity app that you use and want to share with us? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You also write about Dispatch. It's got a lot of similarities to Mailbox, which is the first one we talked about. What's different?
The main difference with Dispatch is it takes what Mailbox is doing with turning emails into tasks, and then it integrates with other services and other apps more closely in order to help you actually act on those emails. And so what you can do is kind of send from your email, send something to Evernote so that you can start taking a note on it, or jump right into Skype so that you can contact someone. It does cost $1.99, while Mailbox is free, but we love it, and I really think one of the keys to being productive with email is, personally for me, using a one-touch rule. And so when I get an email, I either quickly reply or I file it. There's a new new app called MailPilot for OS X, but it's also on iOS, and it lets you actually delay an email, kind of schedule it for when it needs to pop back up to remind you. So I often get stories that are under an embargo, and I have to remember to write them, a week later. And so I can just toggle them to schedule them in a calendar, or, just use the app to set when it's supposed to remind me.
I like that idea a lot.
Yeah, it's really helpful.
Same thing. Sometimes people are contacting me about something that's happening in a month, and I can't think about it right now. Let's see. Another list making, well, a big part of staying productive is the to-do list, and there are plenty of apps for that. I've never found one that works for me, but what do you like about what is it called? Any.do? Any.do?
Sure. Yeah. You know, actually, I don't know how to pronounce that. I was looking it up. And I just call it AnyDo, but I'm sure Any.do works, too, because I think that's stylized. But whether or not we know how to say it, it's a wonderful app. My favorite thing about it is it has a Moments daily planner. And what you can do is throw in all your unscheduled tasks. So things, you know, that you know you need to do. I need to call, you know, my mom and check in with her or something. Mm-hmm. And in the mornings at a certain time, it'll remind you to take a look at your day, and it'll show you any of those tasks that are unscheduled, as well as the ones that you have scheduled for that day. And then if you're feeling up for it, you can add it to your calendar for the day and then, you know, get it done. Or if you want to delay it and just say, okay, I'll deal with it later, you can just push it back down and it'll pop back up, you know, the next day or later on. So it's a great way of taking all the clutter of all the things that we need to do but they're not urgent and putting them somewhere and having them remind us, you know, daily so that we can work through them.
Another app that you mentioned in this category was Asana, and this one is good for collaborating. How does that work?
Yeah, Asana is interesting. It's focused on to-do lists, but it lets you do these to-do lists with your colleagues, and so they're collaborative to-do lists. So I can pop on and add some tasks, and then my coworkers can see them and act on them and interact with them. So it's really good if you're on a project where you need to assign stuff to each other and everyone needs to keep track of what's getting done and what still needs to get done.
Beth in Columbus, you have an idea for an app. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My favorite productivity app or apps at the moment are Buffer and Feedly, because they're free, and they really help if you're managing social media. If you want to get more than one account for Twitter or Facebook, you can. And it just kind of, if you're always posting from Buffer and Feedly, your audience knows, but it just helps when you're just kind of tapped out of ideas, or maybe you don't have the time to sit down and write on your Facebook, and it's, you know, right on the phone. You can check your engagement list, and I just love it. I'm really mad at Evernote for taking out one of their features that made it really special, which was their audio recording. So when you saw something or you had an idea, you could just put it directly to audio along with your image capture. Mm-hmm. And now that's, I don't know if they've just taken it out completely or you have to pay for the professional version, but kind of defeats the purpose of having it for me. Okay. And I'll see what you guys have.
All right, Beth. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Josh, any of those ring a bell?
Sure, yeah. Well, Feedly really got a big boost last year because Google closed down its RSS product, which was called Reader. And Google claimed that not many people were using Reader. And RSS is a very kind of old technology used for syndicating web content so that it can... you can have a list of all these new posts from different websites and blogs or podcasts. But a lot of people have turned to things like Twitter, these new social media services, to get their content. So what Feedly did is they stepped in where Google had decided to step out of, and they created a service that does a great job of collecting all of your different feeds for, things to read, and then giving you great ways to share them with your different networks. Buffer is great for scheduling social media. It does a really good job of connecting with all the different services and giving you some great options for how to schedule. And Evernote really got an early lead on how to manage all your different types of notes and thoughts and different web clippings. But one of the things that they noticed is they were so eager to add features in that their service had recently degraded a bit. And so they're spending this year to focus on getting a lot of the bugs out, making that service.
Are you there? Okay. Real quick, going back to collaboration, I was interested in collaborative writing apps like Quip. How does that work?
Yeah. Quip's it's a great app, and what it does is it lets you work together on a document with someone, and then it creates almost like a feed of the changes and who's editing and when they are. And it's meant to take collaborative document writing into a very modern interface. It's similar. You can do the same stuff with Google Documents,
right?
But or Google Docs. But I really think that Quip, which is founded by the former Facebook CTO Brett Taylor, it really offers just a more attractive and cleaner way to do it.
Okay. All right. We'll have to check that out. Josh Ong, a reporter for The Next Web, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, more on Tech Tuesday with Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For those who tuned into the Super Bowl on Sunday, you might remember that music from an ad that depicted an army of young girls constructing a rocket ship out of their pink, traditionally girl toys. Joining us now to talk about that and other gadget news is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
I think that we've talked about Goldilocks before.
Goldilocks has had two commercials before. This was the second, it has a similar theme each time. The first one was a really neat Rube Goldberg machine.
That's right.
You know, where it was the same basic concept, though. They wanted to do away with the girly things and replace them with these kind of engineering puzzles and stuff. And Goldilocks is pretty cool. I haven't yet set either of my daughters in front of one, but I think that's going to happen soon.
Well, how do they work? I mean, what do they do?
Well, so it's a story. It basically a storybook that tells a story, and along with it is a STEM project of some kind. Typically, some kind of engineering puzzle or something. There's a conveyor belt band that you build from parts in one of the puzzles, and they've got four now, I think, where there are four different puzzles that you can order that each come with this story that basically walks a character through. Why that engineering trick or why that invention would be important, and then encourages the girls to put together, the engineering puzzle on their own and come up with their own uses for it.
That's interesting. I mean, it must go to the whole idea of girls liked stories around their toys.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously the story part is a pretty specific add-on. I think it. I think for my kids anyway, it would definitely go with the idea maybe of like American Girl dolls.
Right, exactly.
Because both my girls have American Girl dolls, and they each have books that, specifically apply to some of the characters that they own.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that definitely plays a part into it.
So you like them? You like the idea?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I'm looking forward to sitting my youngest down, especially, just because she is very much an engineer brain. She likes kind of taking things apart and seeing what's going on inside.
Okay, and you wanted to talk about some of the Twitter activity during the game.
anytime we have, a large event, there's a lot of activity on Twitter. And one of the really interesting things that I thought happened during the Super Bowl specifically was Neil deGrasse Tyson. Mm-hmm. Was remarkably active on Twitter. He does occasionally send a lot of information on Twitter, just kind of adding things. But during the Super Bowl, especially, he had a lot of information to share that I thought was particularly interesting. The first was, if 335-pound terrorist Knighton of the Broncos hits you at 10 miles an hour, it's 40 times the momentum of a 12-gauge shotgun blast to your chest.
People like that. They retweeted it a lot.
Yeah, it got a ton of attention. And so he kept going for the rest of the night. He talked about the Coriolis force that would stop a 50-yard field goal in MetLife Stadium, or rather it would deflect it by about half an inch due to the Earth's rotation. There was a ton of information that he had, and he kept it going throughout the entirety of the Super Bowl, including when he, discovered that he didn't have anything nice to say about what was going on with the Broncos. So
what did he do then?
He started talking about the football field itself and how how that would apply. So it was cool because there's always a ton of activity during a large event like that. But it was interesting to see Neil deGrasse Tyson specifically. And I think a portion of it had to do with one of the Super Bowl commercials being for the return of the show Cosmos, which he is going to be starring in. So I think that probably had something to do with his activity. But the information that he had was a lot of fun either way.
It kind of goes to that idea with social media, particularly with Twitter, is you want to be adding something to the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, because it's something where a single tweet can get, just explosive reach, if the right group of people find it and share it. And it was, all over the place. So many different people had something fun to say. Even actors like Patrick Stewart were doing kind of silly things on Twitter during the game. It was definitely interesting to watch.
Patrick Stewart from what's the show?
You got it. Come on.
It's like the space show.
He might have been like a captain or...
Yeah, Star Trek.
There you go.
Thanks, Amy. Amy Jurevich, my mental bumper.
But yeah, he had several tweets where it was him in a Seahawks uniform doing a bunch of things. It was definitely a lot of fun. He's very active on Twitter as well. So it's very interesting to see how I don't use Twitter a whole lot for communication. I'm almost like a stalker almost. It's kind of odd. Where all of these different people they're usually talking about things that don't have to do with their current work. It's usually just them being people, and that's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun to follow things like State of the Union addresses, national events, and it's incredible how funny people are and how witty and how clever they are.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a constant thing, and it gets a little hard sometimes, when the conversation turns to being not so nice. But it's. it's a lot of fun to see, even with dissenting opinions. It doesn't happen particularly often.
Yeah, and then there's the sad ones that have to do with people like Philip Seymour Hoffman. Thank you, Amy, again. All the RIPs for him dying the other day from the overdose. So. Yeah, it's an interesting part of our life these days. You wanted to talk about Google selling Motorola to, is it Lenovo?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we talked about this when they bought it.
We did talk about this when they bought it because Motorola had been kind of falling to the wayside. They were, one of the first, or really the first, mobile companies as far as, mobile telephone companies. And, in the wake of things like the iPhone and, the rise of Samsung as a major player as far as Android smartphones go, Motorola had kind of fallen to the wayside and the things that they were producing really just weren't great. And Google bought them, and it was really, you know, bizarre to see how, you know, that happen, because Google is specifically a software company. They don't, at the time, they didn't tend to do a whole lot with hardware. Obviously, things are a little different now. They went and, you know, fixed a lot of the things that were broken inside of Motorola. A lot of people who worked for Google went to Motorola as project managers and as the president of the company, you know, to try and fix a lot of the hardware and software problems they had. And in the process of doing that, they released the Moto X and the Moto G, which were both phones that I really liked. Mm-hmm. I still think the Moto X is one of the best phones that you can buy right now if you're not looking for an iPhone. And you know, it was interesting to see how much Motorola had changed over the past year. And apparently Google did not buy them with the intent of keeping them. They stripped out, you know, the hardware part of the business and are now selling it to Lenovo, who currently makes laptops and a ton of other things.
But they kept what?
So they kept the research and development teams for like really special projects that Motorola had been working on for a while, called the Advanced Technologies and Products Division. And they kept the entire patent portfolio for Motorola that they've had since they became a company very, very long time ago.
What does this mean for people who already own Motorola smartphones?
Nothing. You know, one of the things that the Lenovo president said was that if anything happens, if the deal goes through, which is going to take a while for that to even happen, then Lenovo is going to maintain the Moto X and the Moto G in the exact way that it's being maintained right now. So it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to start lacking software updates or anything like that. It's going to be the same thing moving forward. And really what Lenovo can offer Motorola is a you know, global supply chain and the ability to make, you know, hardware that is available all over the world. So that's going to be a really positive thing, hopefully, for both of those companies.
Now, you mentioned that some people may be mourning the breakup of Motorola in this way. You are not one of them.
I think that a lot of people got excited about Motorola because Google had bought them. And there's a certain pull that comes to Google buying a company where they, you know, there's a lot of excitement that pours into that. I think Motorola was a great company who made really, you know, decent hardware. They were one of the first Android manufacturers. They just kind of got lost. The direction that they went, you know, shortly after releasing the Droid phone for Verizon, the original Droid phone, they started making a lot of really weird decisions because of who was in charge there. And I think that a lot of those things got fixed. So I don't think that it's a bad thing. And I'm very excited to see what Motorola is going to do next.
So will Motorola still be Motorola? I mean, will there be a company called Motorola?
There will not be a company called Motorola, just like Lenovo purchased IBM a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And we'll see a lot of the same thing happen with Motorola, where they will be, you know, Lenovo-branded phones, but the design will be very clearly Motorola's design.
There is a game console you wanted to talk about, Ouya.
Yeah.
Has a new version of its Android-based game console. Remind us how this company got started and what Ouya is all about.
So Ouya was the biggest Kickstarter project to have ever existed. They announced this little tiny game console that was going to be $100, and it was going to run Android, and any Android games that you enjoyed playing on your phone, you'd be able to play on your television. There would be a nice kind of custom controller that was made so that you could enjoy that experience on your television. And it did a lot of the same things that your Android phone does. And so, you know, you basically have this $100 game console that is really, you know, pretty powerful. And it took them a while to get there. And one of the things that they figured out along the way was that the storage they originally included in the console was just not enough. It was originally an 8 gigabyte storage unit on the inside. And games since that Kickstarter, you know, games have grown significantly in quality, and with that comes additional size requirements. So it became a pretty serious problem that needed to be addressed. And in doing so, they've released a new version of the console that is going to be 16 gigabytes instead of 8.
So do you see a future for this company? I mean, does this make sense that enough people buy it that you think it's got a chance?
Ouya was hugely successful on Kickstarter, and they got a really early deal with Best Buy, so that Ouyas are now on shelves in Best Buy. I think that this appeals to people who are just kind of casual gamers who don't maybe want to spend the $400 or $500 on a new console, who appreciate a lot of the games that are available for Android, but would like to do something more than just playing it on their tiny screen or on a tablet.
Mm-hmm.
They've sold a ton of them already, and they've already got plans for a new console every year that is going to just be these kind of incremental bumps in performance that allows people to move their accounts from one console to the other. So I think that they've got a really solid idea, and for $100 or now as it is $130, it's inexpensive enough that someone can go, well, maybe I'll like this and buy it.
And it's inexpensive enough where you don't mind buying it when it gets upgraded again.
Exactly.
Hmm. Windows 8.1 update.
We have a new update to Windows 8.1 coming. We talked about the last update to Windows 8.1 a little while ago.
We talked about it a lot.
We did talk about it a lot, because one of the big things that really frustrated people about Windows 8 when it first came out was that it was confusing and it was hard to use. The start menu seemed to have disappeared, and really Microsoft tried way too hard to keep the desktop and the kind of modern UI that they had set up separate, which confused a lot of people who weren't using touchscreens.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there were very few people using touchscreens. Right now, you walk into a Best Buy or a Staples, and almost every laptop on the shelf has got a touchscreen of some kind. While they're not selling quite as well as they had been in the past, there's still a significant group of these new users or new PC owners who have adjusted to touch. But at the same time, it was a really bad idea to try and keep the desktop experience and the kind of almost tablet-like experience separate, because it made twice as much work for developers, for users who only wanted to stay in the desktop mode like myself. So they tried to make Windows 8.1, easier to switch back and forth in between, easier to set up and easier to customize, so that it was kind of a better all-around experience. And I think they did a really good job. But we've reached that point, now a couple months later, where there are still some changes that need to be made.
So you've just gotten a lot of this from leaks from Microsoft?
Microsoft has been talking about it for a little while, and mm-hmm. their developer conference where they announce, where they show off what's going to happen for the next year, both for their phones and for their computers, is a couple of weeks away. So a big thing that we've seen over the last couple of weeks is them, just kind of examples of what it is they've got moving forward. And it's not everything. There's obviously going to be a lot more changes, especially to the phone part, the Windows 8.1 for mobile devices over the next couple of weeks, especially with Samsung and Nokia. But for the desktop, what we've seen so far is, more chances to take the modern UI experience where you've got these little tiny tiles and actually moving them to the desktop as kind of shortcuts, so that there's more of a bleed in between those two experiences.
So are those the Metro apps?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, they got sued, so they can't call them Metro anymore.
Okay.
But it's the same basic idea.
So what are they calling them again?
I think they haven't stuck with like an actual marketing name for it, but the name of the user interface is Modern UI.
Okay, we just have like a minute left. What about the startup screen?
So the startup screen is going to be focus more like they did before on making it as customizable as possible and making it easier to get to the desktop, and even making it so that you can avoid it altogether and just go straight to the desktop, whereby having that enabled by default in certain situations.
Hmm. All right. Well, I have a feeling we'll talk about this again.
I think so.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us today again, as always.
Bye.
Russell Holly, he's tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.